We encourage successful experiments, but we punish failed experiments.
Yep.
With death.
With, well, not mostly with garnished wages. Scotch.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 280 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast, Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm caffeinated too much and too little at the same time.
I'm Sam.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is October 9th, 2020. Before we get started, we have a warning. We're going to swear. We're just going to do it. It's going to happen. Yep. Brace yourself. We'd also like to thank our recurring supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. They just keep giving us money and we keep grabbing it.
It's great.
I like it. Let's do more of that.
Yes.
All right. So we're going to be – the things are going to be a little loosey-goosey on today's episode because Sam's about to go on a spiritual journey into the spirit realm of Iowa.
Yep.
And because of that, we have had very little time since we've recorded the last episode. Which means not much has happened except for one big thing, which is our quarterly review. So we're just going to talk about some of the ideas and possibly ideals that came out of that.
Yeah, I do want to say I think quarterly reviews. We talk about them. We talk about them. I think every quarter we go over kind of what happened on the podcast. But I think they do have this very comical, I would say, kind of. They got a bad rap, I feel like, in general.
I fucking love quarterly reviews.
Yeah, in businesses, like, I feel like when someone's like, oh, God, quarterly reviews today, you know, it's going to be a thing. But we managed to turn them into some pretty – they're always great. And then afterwards, we usually have too many ideas is sort of the problem. All of our priorities get shifted. Projects get upended. New things get thrown on the board. Everyone knows what they're doing. It's always very exciting.
Oh, it's chaos.
It's great. It's
madness.
I love it. I don't know why people aren't into it.
Well, I don't know either, but I know one thing, which is we decided to name this next quarter after our quarterly review because of what we learned, because of all the cool shit we figured out. And this next quarter coming up is the Big Brain Quarter. In sort of like a high-level summary, it's we're going to try to prioritize – thinking about stuff more before we do them. Yep. That's kind of that's the long and the short of it.
And that includes organizing stuff. So like if you're going to make a thing, you know what you need to do. Who else is involved? Who, like, what are you going to need from them? Now, instead of waiting until the moment you need it downstream, once you've been working on the thing, maybe.
And then now you're stuck.
Now you
got to go.
Yeah. And now
interrupt them.
Yeah. So now maybe don't do that. And instead line that all up ahead of time. Set up any scheduled meetings that you need if you need any at all, or set up some async requests. So just send some emails or make some Trello cards or whatever system you're using and get all of those things in play so that by the time you do get there, everything is already resolved and you don't have to interrupt somebody synchronously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, before we talk about how this hits the life cycle of game development, because we also had a kind of a hilarious realization about this.
Well, these two things are closely related.
They're very closely related. And I also want to talk about how this relates to just like just doing stuff generally. So since the pandemic started, I have slowly been morphing into Skeletor. I've been just kind of I haven't been lifting weights, no gym, you know, no structure, no CrossFit classes, none of that stuff. I was doing some exercises early. But they were so boring. It's just body weight. Like, I'm just going to do like a trillion push-ups and 9,000 sit-ups. And, you know, by the time you're done with it, you know, you've died of old age.
And you've thrown no tires. So
no tires have been thrown.
What's even the point?
No heavy objects have been slammed and then grunted at.
It doesn't have nearly as good a tactile feel. Of
just not satisfying.
Yep.
Just doing 400 air squats. It's just not satisfying. So I just totally – fell off that. And then, you know, I do that thing that probably a lot of our listeners do. Many people do is you every now and then you go, I really need to get on top of this. I really need to just get back in shape. And then, you know, the next day, maybe if you remember by the next day, you'll do like two or three squats and you're like, I'm bored now. And then you just wander off and then that's the end of it for the next month. So, so what I did a few weeks back now is I took a couple hours on Sunday and I just sat down, turned off my devices, you know, got a notebook. And I was like, I'm just going to design myself a 10-week plan. We're like down to the details. I'm going to plan out like – I'm going to look at my calendar ahead of time. When am I going to work out? What am I going to do on each day? What are the kinds of things that I'm going to run into that might derail my plan, right? Mm-hmm. If I have events that I know ahead of time, then I'll move the workout dates, you know, around them so that I already have decided which days are rest day, you know, just pre-decide everything, right? And also knowing what kinds of things I'm interested in doing, you know, like down to every single rep. What am I doing in the next 10 weeks? So I did that, and sure enough, now for the past few weeks, it's been incredibly easy to just go in there, work hard. I've been putting in 40 to 60 minutes per session. I'm getting back into it, right? Mm-hmm. And it's all just because all I did was just. Instead of just constantly having to re-evaluate at every single second of the process what I need to do next and be constantly making decisions, I've already figured out most of the problems ahead of time. So this is like the mantra of the big brain quarter. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's talk about how this comes back to game development.
Yeah. So there's a lot of after, you know, we did a bunch of research into pre-production methods. What is this idea of pre-production? We've been talking about pre-production a lot on the podcast because it's the first time that we're doing it on purpose. And one of the things that's become increasingly clear is that pre-production is actually the time at which, for the most part, if you have a team in place that can make a game, then pre-production is the time where the decisions that get made are the things that decide the fate of the game. Is it going to be successful or not? Is it going to hit the market correctly or not? Are you going to be able to get a business deal with it or not?
Yeah. What's the game going to look like? What's the music going to be like? What's the what's the business model of the game?
And is the mechanical set that you're putting forward unique enough, or the whole vision of the thing unique enough that it's something that anybody would actually want to buy? And so it was one of those weird realizations we had in going through the pre-production process that, one, that we'd never done it before purposely, which ended up being one of those horrifying realizations, I feel like, when you look back when you're like, wow, it's kind of like doing this whole, I didn't work out for 2 years because I never took, an afternoon to really, really think about what it would mean to like start digging in and building a schedule for this thing. So much is actually decided during the pre-production phase that we realize that it's really weird. It's actually really fucking weird that it doesn't have a name. It is, in fact, only referred to
by – pre-production.
Yeah, by its relationship to doing the work, which, by the way, again, the doing of the work is something that is sort of like it's required, but it's not going to be the thing
that – Production.
Yeah, production. Yeah. But it's not necessarily the thing that decides the fate of the game on a high level. And so it's so – you know what reminds me of this? It's almost like when humans thought that Earth was the center of everything and then slowly had to like fight their way out of that.
It totally is. Yeah.
Because the reality is
– obviously the sun is the center of the universe, know?
Mm-hmm. And then – yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it just keeps going up. And so I think there's –
Except no, it's not. Yeah.
There's this really interesting thing that happens, which we ended up talking about during our quarterly, which is that – a lot of – basically if you can measure something, then that's the sort of thing that tends to get planned around and tends to become a thing of very high importance because people can see it. They can understand it. They can put it on schedules. They can do X, Y, or Z. Pre-production is not the sort of thing that you can
– Can't measure it.
Can't measure it. You can't schedule it. Figuring out the changes and the little prototyping switches during the pre-production process before you kind of know what the game is a very chaotic process. And so it suddenly became clear to us during this discussion that like, oh, the reason it's called pre-production instead of production is because production is the thing that people can manage. And so therefore everyone wants to get to production. By everyone, I mean project managers and business people as quickly as possible. and us.
That's when you feel like you have something to show, right? But that's also when all of your people feel like they're doing work, like actually, because it's called producing, right? Like you're producing stuff. Yeah.
And one of the hardest sort of tension points during pre-production is fighting that feeling of like, am I doing things right now? Like if I take, you know, same thing with scheduling or figuring out the schedule for doing a workout, you're not doing the workout during that phase.
At the end of that planning phase, you have nothing to show.
Yes.
You have nothing to deliver.
And yeah. And pre-production, which we'll talk about a different word for it shortly, but pre-production can often feel like that, where you might spend, in my case, you know, I spent basically 6 weeks pounding out a bunch of design details for Crash Lands 2 before we even touched a bit of code about it.
Or even art assets.
I was doing just hideous paint drawings, essentially, to kind of vaguely get an idea across of what the whole thing was supposed to look like. And so it's one of those weird things where at the end of it, you still don't have anything. You got nothing.
There's no game. Nobody can play the game.
and there's still some untested ideas in there, right? Which is all about what pre-production is. And so it can be very challenging to stay on course and to not accidentally, essentially, just start trying to do stuff and just start building, you know, and this is sort of where we have, I think, classically existed. And this is, I'm sure some of our listeners are going to be amused, as they have been amused in the past, by us switching to DevOps and being like, oh my God, if you focus on your processes and planning, then you get more stuff done. It should be surprising, but none of this is particularly surprising, I think, but it's definitely sort of been the core thing that our studio has been trying to grow into, is to think more, before we start just slamming our faces into stuff at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. Because what you don't want is – you don't want to start building a project unplanned, get a whole year into it, realize there's no market for this then, yeah. Right? Because the game is solid at that point. It cannot be easily sort of morphed into a whole other kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, it's also not just a matter of changing it into an entirely new thing. It's that if you're not even identified the questions you have, and then even the ones you have identified, if you've not answered them, and your plan is to answer them or discover them during the production process, which, as Seth, as you're saying, is the time when you're turning the thing into stone over time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if during that process is where you discover how you want the thing to be, then now the cost of every new discovery is extremely high because it happens in the context of a thing that is turning into stone, right? And so being able to then work backwards and make changes that propagate through the entire system to allow for that change or to allow for that newly answered question, right, is just extremely costly. And if we look at like Levelhead's development, its whole development was that. The whole thing from beginning to end was the original question that we answered was or asked was then answered in the prototype in like the first 2 weeks. And then after that, yep, we asked and answered questions just as part of production. It was just the same. Mm-hmm. They were completely intermixed in terms of that process. And it worked out okay, yep, because that game from a like what it was perspective was straightforward enough that could work in that context. Like it was still costly, but it could work there. But if it was a systems-heavy game where we were adding in like, ooh, now we want an inventory, or ooh, now we want this, or whatever, right? And we did all that in the same way, it would have been very hard and very costly.
And it was very hard at a couple of different points. So importantly, you know, our Levelhead players will know that the undo function, the ability to undo what you just did in the Levelhead editor, took until just a couple months before launch for us to get in. And there's a big reason for that, which is that by the time undo came around, or because by the time we decided to do it, which again, we could have and probably should have decided when we were building the damn editor in the first place. But because we put it off, there were so many items in the game. We essentially put the cart before the horse, right? There are so many things on top of this.
And none of these things designed around the – yeah. There were now a ton of systems that all didn't know about the concept of an undo being a thing and were all different and weren't built with undo in mind. So now – so even if we didn't start with undo but knew we were going to do it, so that everything was built with a plan where we're like, okay, once we add undo, here's how it's going to work for this new system. And in fact, here's our checklist of when we add a new system, here are the things we have to remember, It needs to be undoable at some point. It needs to be maybe redo. We never did redo, but right. But if that was a thing, then we would have had that on the list, right? So that you now wouldn't be able to build a new system without first sitting down and asking, what is the full parameter set? What is the full set of requirements to actually make this thing work? Instead of just, how do I get the one idea, which in this case was this one item? How do I get this item or this new kind of item into the game as fast as possible? Because mm-hmm. if that's the goal, then you do that in a non-systems way, in a way that doesn't take into account the future. It takes into account only the minimum amount of present, right, to be able to make the
thing. To do that one thing.
Which, again, from a jam mindset, which is where the studio sort of arose, is literally exactly what you need to do. Because there's nothing happening after the jam. There's 2 days, and you just got to cram stuff in there, and you shouldn't be caring during a jam. And that can be a good way to, you know, discover a new system, discover a new project, whatever else. But it is if you jam for your production process, which is sort of what we've done classically, then you're going to start running into these situations that become these almost intractable nightmares. I mean, the undo thing was it three weeks?
It was a lot. Yeah,
it was 3 weeks.
And there's still bugs in it, because at the time that we added the undo to the game, the editor was like 15,000 lines of code, and because so many of those lines of code were approached in that way of like, ooh, here's this little feature we want. Let's just tack it onto this system. Oh, this other feature, let's just tack it onto that. And there was never this, like, at the very beginning, there was never this intent to make that editor extremely flexible from a code perspective, so that it was really, really easy to just add new tools, add new systems, whatever. Because of the production mindset, because the idea was always, we need to get this next thing out, period. Mm-hmm. So what's the minimum number of things we can do to get this next thing out? And like our players often said, especially during the early access, we deploy these patches week by week, and each patch just had tons of stuff in it.
Yeah.
Just tons of stuff, which is totally doable earlier in the life cycle of a game. But the faster you are cramming stuff in a non-systems oriented way, the harder it is to add the next thing, right? Mm-hmm. And eventually you reach a point where
you have to refactor the whole fucking thing.
You got to redo the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to approach Crashlands 2 in a very different way, where it's like, okay, this first even like 6 months of development, it's actually okay. It's okay if after 6 months we don't have a lot of content in the game, because that's not the point at this stage. This is the first stage of this dev cycle, which we're just calling – it's not pre-production. It's R&D, okay? Mm-hmm. It's not defined in relation to production. It's we are coming up with the best ways to build this game. And
what the game is. Right,
and we're figuring out what the game is. Yeah. So if we aren't actively answering questions about what the game is and how to build it, then we're doing the wrong thing, because that's the phase that we're in. So we've kind of like rethought this idea of, instead of pre-production and production and launch, we're thinking about the game dev cycle as four phases, which is the R&D phase, which, like we said, is answering questions about what the game is and how you're going
to
build it.
And developing the tools to build it. And so it's basically getting everything ready.
So you are building stuff.
Yeah, you're making stuff.
But you're not building it to deliver it. You're building it to answer questions.
Yeah.
Which is a very different mindset. Mm-hmm. And that even means like stuff that we've done already with Crashlands 2 is spent several days just working out the lighting system. How did it work in the original Crashlands? How do we make it better? What are the problems that it had? And just spending that time up front working on shaders, trying to figure out post-processing effects to make the world look more beautiful. You know, and we're still working on that stuff.
And the key there is trying out different ones. But we're not saving this until, we're now halfway through development. We've got like all the items in that we want, right? And we got like the stories in there. We got our NPCs. We have we have everything. Now, let's figure out
how to put lighting in here. That's just content.
Yeah. Yep. So the idea is up front, before we have infinite content, right? It's you tackle each system and ask, how does this system work? With the goal being that by the time we start really trying to push on content and actually like making the game, that we now know every single system, we've experimented with ways that it might work. We've implemented basically partial versions of each one of those to get at those original questions and to have something that we can start to use. We've built tools around each one of those systems so that we can add content rapidly, or we can test things, or whatever it is that we need to do with that particular thing, so that by the time we get done with this phase, we are ready to produce.
Yep. So that's the first phase, R&D. Phase two is the grind, which this would typically be referred to as the production phase, right? This is when you're like, I know basically what needs to happen.
Yep.
We have the tools, most of the tools that we need to make this game.
40 enemies, 600 environment tiles, and 1,000 items.
Yeah.
Okay.
We need a world that players could spend 300 hours exploring before they run out of stuff to find. We need we need 2,000 quests. We need NPCs.
And importantly, we don't know the details yet, but we know how NPCs work. We know how quests work. We know what it means to add those into the game, what it means
to
add
what the story is on a high level.
We know what the story is. We haven't written it, so we don't know what any given line of the story is, right?
Yeah. But
we
know. So this is the grind. This is like we know how. We don't necessarily know what yet, but we know how. And now we put in the work. This is the production.
And there may be still some slightly, because this doesn't mean that every question is now like answered and in stone, right? This means that to the best of our ability now, knowing the whole thing and having a plan for the whole thing, we have identified every question that we possibly could up front. And we have an answer for each one of those questions up front. But not just an answer. We actually have a realm of answers and like what that kind of looks like. So that now, like lighting is a good example. We think we know what lighting is going to look like, right, and how it's going to work because we've experimented now with a whole bunch of stuff. We still have some ideas, some experiments to run, but it's quite possible by the time we get into the middle of the content phase now have a whole bunch of different zones and a whole bunch of different items and who knows, seasonal effects. Like we don't know what's going to go into this thing, right? But there's a whole bunch of now things that could be in here. And so in that context, it may turn out that actually a few of our plans were wrong, right? A few of our answers were not quite right because we didn't have the full scope of the problem. But at that point, it's fine because we already know what the shape of the answer looks like. And we've already done the exploratory work to know how do we even explore possible answers to this question. So that at this point, it's just a matter of like fine-tuning the details and that's it.
Yeah. So that's all the grind. We're just putting in that work, fine-tuning stuff, making the content. Then the next phase, phase three, is pre-launch. So this is we're at a point now where we need to essentially get everything cinched up and finalized and start ramping up the marketing engine, right? And like all throughout the grind,
engine, because deployment is a non-trivial task.
Well, that's what I was gonna say is actually through the grind, we should have been actively deploying to all target platforms and testing on all platforms the entire time. So if you've done your DevOps, then there shouldn't be any new challenges in the pre-launch phase when it comes to getting the game playable on an Xbox
pre-launch should be focused again on the details, like making sure every aspect of your store pages is correct, making sure you've lined up every part of your marketing process and it's ready to go. But that should be fine tuning because all of those things should have already been built and maintained throughout the grind.
Yeah. So then there's this one thing that happens, which is the launch, which is like a single day. It's not really a stage of development. It's just like an event, right? And on launch day, generally you're not doing anything because all the work to make the launch happen, you already did all of that for the preceding 4 months.
Or this is now if are some manual buttons you have to click, like for things you can't schedule because you should have scheduled everything that's possibly schedulable, right?
Yeah.
Or anything that you couldn't, like this is where you hit those buttons. But that's all the launch is. It's just those few manual things that had to be done to separate unlaunched from launched.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then the final phase is post-launch. And the post-launch phase is people often think about the launch as like, oh, it's done now. Like the game's out now and we finished the project. It's in players' hands. Post-launch is actually – it's kind of like a chaotic mix of things. because you don't know what's next, right? Mm-hmm. Post-launch is now you need to evaluate. How did the game perform? What were our expectations? What were our like best and worst case scenarios? And kind of where did we land on that? Do we keep developing the game? Do we deploy some patches? Do we make DLC?
Do we aggressively go after business deals?
Yeah. Do we need to scale up? Do we need to scale down? Did it go that badly? So there's a whole bunch of things that need to happen, but that is a totally distinct phase of development where you have to make a lot of decisions and do a lot of things in that post-launch phase that you don't really need to do or think about in pretty much any other phase of the development.
Although I will say,
pre-launch, you should do some pre-planning about what your post-launch scenarios could be and what you think you're going to do for those.
And not just the scenarios, because increasingly because of the live ops-y nature of literally every game now, increasingly not having a plan for what sort of content you're going to deliver and how you're going to deliver it post-launch is a really bad idea because again, it comes back to how you're thinking about your systems and how you're thinking about the way you're putting what content into your game currently. So this is a big problem we had with the original Crashlands, which is that it wasn't built in a modular enough way for us to be able to add let's add a side zone over here.
Adding content is very hard in Crashlands.
Because Crashlands is just a vertical stack of quests, and so being like, yeah, we're going to put this content here. There, wherever else, if we put anything anywhere besides the savannah, the sort of first zone of the game, the likelihood of players, of any new players seeing that content was low, because we knew that about half of people by the time they get to the bog, that's sort of like where they cap out for 10-ish hours of play.
But also old players won't see it because they're already past that content.
Yeah, they're going to be way too high level. So then it's like, okay, so the game wasn't built to be able to handle literally any additional content. That was actually quote unquote additional content and not stuff that would sort of be defunct if you were a late game player or.
But you see this in any kind of game where there's a linear progression, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's the same deal. If you want to add content to the end for your old players, and add content to the beginning to make the new player experience more valuable and interesting, and. Both of those things then miss the other segment of your player population. So you can't just make content that everybody gets to now go experience. And versus a game that's a little more sort of horizontal in the sense of like what the gameplay experience is like, where adding a new weapon to Fortnite, right? Mm-hmm. It's just a horizontal thing. Like anybody can go use it at any moment. They get to experience that content no matter how good or bad they are, no matter how long they play the game. New content actually like dramatically improves the game for everybody the moment it goes in. But for something like Crash and for Crashlands too, it's the kind of stuff you can add and the impact is also light. So sorry for Crashlands mm-hmm. also, not Crashlands the number two. Because if you want to add something like really cool, like a new zone with new content, then now all of a sudden the effort required to do that is fucking enormous, right? Because mm-hmm. now you have to come up with all the tile sets that make up the space. You have to now come up with a new set of resources. You have to come up with a new set of progression of items. Like the whole thing is very, very hard to add. It's both very hard to insert into and very hard just to add mm-hmm. entirely new sets of content.
Yeah. So, we're trying to think about these things in this stage of how do we avoid those problems downstream, in Crashlands 2, how do we make it super easy to add stuff and keep those options open for ourselves if the opportunity arises, right? It's been an interesting, it was a great quarterly review. I feel like, that kind of realization that like people are so focused on production that we don't even have a name for the thing, the most important thing, which is the thing that comes before production, mm-hmm. yep. pre-production, the thing before production. So this is our big brain quarter. We're very excited. We're still deep in that R&D phase of Crashlands 2, but it's going super good. So,
yeah, but I think the kind of the important part of this is that framing is super important to how people perceive their work, how people structure their companies and their business, and how they orient towards problem solving, right? Because if you use words like pre-production versus production, it implies that the center of everything is the production part, right? And it yep. also implies you should be minimizing how much time goes into anything else, because yep. production also means to produce. That's where all the value is supposed to be.
Well, anything with pre you know, before it, you're going to want to finish that as soon as possible because it's not the thing. It's
exactly. You got to get through that. Yeah. Uh-huh. And so
it's just a big nothing. Mm-hmm. It's a big nothing burger.
Yeah. It's just one of those things where words matter because framing matters, right? And it impacts how you see a thing. And so this is one of our goals here is to reframe how we see all parts of the development process by just rewording, like renaming the parts of it to properly emphasize what they are. Because also the fact that changing production to the grind, right, moves it from like, this is where all the great stuff is happening, right? This is where all the value comes to being like, oh, this is the shit we have to get through. Not
this is just like a lot of work.
It's just a lot of work. It's just the stuff we have to get through to get to the point where we can actually now get ready to launch this thing, right?
Which means the framing around building tools becomes even more important because you're like, oh man, yeah, we need to make sure in the R&D phase we build enough tools that the grind is easy.
Yep.
Because the grind should be easy. I gotta ask though, because of course we did deliberately go and name what we had like pre-launch and post-launch. Like those aren't things either. We just framed them around the launch, which is nothing, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like
that's true.
It's so easy to fall into these traps because really pre-launch is your heavy marketing phase.
Yep.
Is what it is. You know, you're not pre-launching the game because pre-launching something is nothing, right? Mm-hmm. You are heavily marketing the game. And post-launch, what is that? That's your – what is that? What are you doing? You know? Because you don't post-launch stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's not an activity that you can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's
Look at that. We already fucked it up.
Yeah.
We'll have to throw it. Let me retype this. Heavy marketing. Okay. We'll have to come back next week.
Punchier names for these, definitely.
Yeah. I like how here we are. We're like, yeah, framing's super important. You can't call something pre-production. We're like, anyway, here's the new four phases of development. And then we just fell right into the trap.
Well, no, I think the benefit or the difference though between pre-launch and post-launch is that they're both oriented around a single day, which does actually make them very different from a pre-production versus production sort of thing. Because production is something that can last literally years, right? So
But it's also the case that they aren't descriptive about what actually occurs in that phase.
100%.
By being purely oriented around some other completely different thing.
I'll just say we're still figuring it out.
It's pretty wild.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild. All right, let's get on to some questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. Highest upvoted question comes from Chalosis, who says, "What are the Game Maker project files called for all of your past games? In other words, is Crashlands still called RoombaPrototype.yyp?" So this is probably coming from the fact that, you know, as we were talking about, Levelhead never had pre-production. It just went into production on day one. We didn't know what the name of the game was until 7 weeks in. So the Game Maker project was called Platformer Builder.
Yeah, and we could have, of course, we were only 7 weeks in, we could have renamed the project to Levelhead.
Yeah, but we didn't.
We didn't because we didn't see that as an important like thing. I'm not exactly sure what like why that particular ball got dropped, because then by the time we actually paid any attention at all and we're like, oh shit, we already had this out to players and we couldn't change it because then it would remove people's access to their save file.
Yeah, and this only matters for people who are digging through their Windows directory trying to find where the game's files are located.
Yep.
Which you generally should not be doing because you can easily break stuff if you just start deleting or moving files around.
I mean, that said, because this is now treating like the end user as a completely different – or actually what this is it's treating our internal users, ourselves in QA, as people who have to know extra knowledge to be able to do things that our players would also have to know. We just say they don't need to, so who cares, right? Because what this also meant is that for the entirety of Levelhead's development, all of us on the team had to remember that the folder
Platformer Builder
was called Platformer Builder. And I know for myself, because I had to dip into that a lot more rarely, but I still had to periodically. And then every time I did it, I would go look for Levelhead and I wouldn't find it. I'd be like, oh yeah, it's called Platformer Builder.
Platformer Builder. Yeah, and so actually, Towel Fight 2 is called GTFO. Yeah. Because originally it was like – it was actually the original concept of Towel Fight, like story-wise, was actually pretty similar to the original – or the Crashlands story, which was you were going to have crashed in this weird land in a rocket and you had to go find the pieces of your rocket and then get the fuck out of there.
Yeah.
But
didn't we build that?
We built parts of it.
Because we built a game that had that mechanic in it. Do you remember the spider? Oh, thing?
The spider exploding heads game. Yeah, that game was called, oh, shucks, I crashed my spaceship, and now I have to explode heads until I can find all the parts so I can rebuild my spaceship and
that's
escape.
The one. I'm impressed you remembered that title because that was a long...
I think I might have fudged some of it.
But that was in our more verbose days. But yeah, we took that because it was super fun. But I mean, the mechanic was fun, but the overall point was very fun, which is that there were like four rocket pieces scattered around this little tiny planet, and then you had to go get them and bring them back to your ship. So for Tau Fight 2, we were like, we'll just do that. And then, of course, we didn't, because that was literally as far as we planned before we just started building shit. Ended up being a game about, you know, shooting animals. But
this is one of those classic problems, though, because this isn't just about like pre-production versus production, or R&D versus the grind, right? So part of it is we didn't separate those two concepts in a meaningful way for all these past games. And so that meant that there wasn't a phase where we're like, okay, now we know what the name is. There's a process now. When we know what the name is, we go rename things, right? We get everything ready to go. There isn't a thing like that, because discovering the name for our titles was just a thing that happened during development, right? It wasn't like it didn't have any triggers that came off of it. But this is actually a really central problem anytime people are using a thing while it's in development. So we have this, we deal with this with our internal tools as well, right? So we variably, as Seth can attest, we've got this handful of internal tools that are named things like GMS2 tools, the game developer toolkit,
pipeline development kit.
Pipeline development toolkit. Right?
A whole bunch of things around that
as we're developing them, we need to call them something so we can make a project and we can start working on it. We can make command line commands that have a name that you can type into the console, right? All those things have to exist in the same way that as you're working on the game and prototyping it, you may not know yet what the name of this thing is, because you might be doing trademark searches. You might be doing, God knows, like for Crashlands 2, very easy. It's the second Crashlands game. It's called Crashlands 2. Yeah. Like we didn't have to work on that one, right? But for Levelhead, we didn't know what the fuck that was going to be called. We knew what we wanted to make well before we had any idea what the sort of the IP was, and like what the marketing kind of approach was. So we've just been dealing with this in house, just with our tools. Where I had Sam, was that last week? Mm-hmm. Sit down to come up with name options for these internal tools that I've been developing for Seth and Sher to use. But then he did that, which was great. But then I had to go rename everything, right? So I had to go through our code and like find every reference to all these names and change all of it and then republish them to different places and do all this stuff. And then let Seth and Sher know, like, okay, here's the new versions of these things. I had to go label the other ones as deprecated so they would get warnings next time they try to use. There's like all this, like renaming things is a big fucking pain in the ass.
But
right?
The funny thing is, with that tool in particular, you actually knew exactly what those were supposed to be doing before you started building them, right?
Yeah.
So actually, we could have named him.
We could have named him,
you know.
Well, and this is actually something that it's not just us, and it's not even small companies. This happens to everybody, and actually, the larger a company is, the harder it is to change the names of things.
Yep.
I'm not gonna explain specific details because of NDAs, but I will say that just about every time we have worked with a large company, we're talking billion-dollar companies with tens of thousands of employees in some cases. Anytime we're working with some kind of back-end system they have, whether it's a new like way to deliver games or some SDK that we have to integrate or whatever it is always, always named some incoherent string of letters.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Because it started as some kind of concept they were coming up with. You know, maybe they'll be like, oh, new way of playing games, they'll call it. And it's like, okay, it's like NWPG. All right, we'll just register NWPG.net and we'll start using that and set up all the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And then pretty soon, now you got to sign up at this weird website that you have no idea what it is. I don't think that's a real site, but you know.
Don't go there, because if you're playing website roulette, there's no upside there.
Yeah, but conceptually, this is what we run into all the time. And it becomes really, really hard as a developer to figure out what you're su- supposed to actually be doing, because none of the words you're seeing mean the things that they actually are. Usually they're not even real words. And this kind of comes back to the big brain problem, right? The big brain problem of think about stuff as early as you can and make those big hard changes before they become.
And a lot of it is identifying, because as you said, like, I should have known when I went and set out to build those tools that like these need to have names that a person can hold on to, right? They need to have names that are not necessarily describing what it does, even, because that's actually that's what the names are currently. That's what the new way of delivering games, right? That's a tendency, especially as an engineer, right? Is you start building the thing and you're like, okay, I know what this has to do. So like you start naming it accordingly so that you, when you're looking at it, you're like, oh yeah, this is the thing that does this because it says that right there, right? And it feels like it's easier to use that as like the name of the thing, right? And that's true if you are the person building it and that is your full-time job. That is absolutely true. The moment you need somebody else to use it, if they're not using it literally 24/7, then it needs to have an identity that a person can latch on to, right? Yeah. You need a brand so that people can latch on to the idea. And if you – the cost of not doing that ahead of time is high, because even – so yesterday I actually spent – just on this topic, I spent like – an hour and a half going through, because Seth was ready to get started using the newer version of one of my tool sets that works on GameMaker 2.3. And I was like, oh shit, I'm not ready for this because I haven't gone back and actually finished all of the renaming stuff after Sam did his pass on like giving it a name, right? And so I had to go through, I had to change the names of like 30 files. I had to do find and replace, but with, you know, cap sensitive, to go through and like find all of the places where the original thing was referenced and figure out what the is it a code now? So I have to like make sure that I'm being very careful when I change it, or is it just like in the documentation? In which case I still need to be careful, because like in the context of the documentation, the prior way of doing it needed the in front of it and now it doesn't, right? And so like it just like this bullshit where now like the mental overhead and like the just the cost of going through and fixing a thing after the fact is just stupidly high. And so either you want to already handle that up front, or if you can't, because like you need to get started on development and you
– sometimes you got to figure out what it is while you're –
you got to figure out what it is. Then know that and still know what it is you're going to need to do in the future, like rename everything, right? And have a fucking plan. Yep. So that now you can say, okay, well, I've already got a script that I made that will convert – this blank name that I made, right? That I made a unique thing that definitely is not going to, because also if you call it something like game prototype or prototype or some really generic thing, then now it's not even a simple matter of just find and replace. Now it's a matter of, oh shit, where did I use this that it doesn't mean the same thing? Right? So it's like, come up with a unique thing, use that everywhere, and already have your script written and tested that just renames everything.
Yeah,
you know,
just honestly, yeah, renaming shit is like the perennial problem just across the board for any kind of long-term work. So, man, if you can figure that out, if you figure out the names of things in advance,
that'll help a lot. If you can't, just put in your brain pan like, oh no, this is going to be a problem, right? Just
and try to plan around it at least as you
move forward. At minimum, use very unique names so that you can then find all of the right references to the thing.
Or create an incoherent string of random characters, because that's what it's going to end up being anyways, and just make those really easy to replace. All right, next question comes from Grintrim Gapaquip.
That's a good one.
Grintrim says, hi there. I have a few questions about GR18's design. Is the display on his face CRT, hologram, LCD, or LED? So we'll kind of hit these real quick one at a time, because there's like three or four questions in here. All right. So display, it's a LJD. It's a liquid juice display.
Yeah.
It does not use pixels at all. It just shapes the juice.
Yeah, there's constant streams of juice shooting onto it, and there's tiny wiper blades where the other pixels – like the pixels are either where juice goes, right? It's like it's a little juice squirter plus a wiper blade, because otherwise the juice runs down the screen. So anything that isn't actively squirting juice has a tiny wiper blade that's actively removing juice.
Well, yeah, it's a combination of wiper blade plus vacuum. So I had this guy come and clean my carpet once. And he had this giant thing. It was like a big circle, and it was hooked up to the plumbing. right? It's almost like a pressure washer, okay? Like, it's mixing soap and blasting water, and it's also a vacuum at the same time. So it's blasting the carpet, shampooing it, and sucking up all of the liquid simultaneously.
Amazing. Right?
So that's what a liquid juice display is like. One thing, though, is like the reason why the game is zoomed out so far is because it's fucking loud. Like, it makes so much noise to make that zoom, kind of a display.
If you zoom in on it, you can really hear it.
If you zoom in on Giratine's face, like, it's just deafening because you're just right there next to the blasting of the juice. So, next question in this series, were all models of GR18 powered by burritos or only the newer versions? And what flavor are they?
They're not powered by burritos. They just carry burritos.
It's kind of like there's dogs that are trained to deliver emergency supplies to people in the mountains.
Yep.
It's like that. You just, you know, especially when you're in space, like, burritos last a long time. They keep very well in space.
Well, it's also in a cryo chamber, so specifically. Yeah. So they keep basically indefinitely inside of a GR18.
Yeah. So there's a lot of times where an emergency situation comes along and somebody's going to need a burrito.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be real. Earthquake. Somebody's going to need a burrito.
Frankly, 2020, we could all use a burrito.
Everybody needs a burrito.
I want a burrito right now.
Mm-hmm. And it's incredibly rare to come across some kind of large-scale emergency or tragedy where somebody doesn't need a burrito in that situation. So it's just always useful. If I was to attempt to open up my GR18 and tinker around, would it void my warranty? I'm totally not trying to reverse engineer it.
Also, good joke thinking that we'd have a warranty on GR18.
There's no warranty on
GR18. There's no warranty.
No.
Also, you're an employee. You don't get warranties. That's not how that works. You know?
Yeah.
You break it, you buy it. I'm pretty sure that's a policy. You break it, you buy it. It's coming out of your paycheck that doesn't exist because you're an unpaid intern.
Yeah, because
it comes out of your future possible paycheck. But it comes out of your paycheck if you go work for another company and actually do make money. We put a lien on that. Or whatever you call it, garnish your wages.
The Bureau doesn't sell GR18s. They provide them to the employees just for the purpose of training and delivery. So you're not going to get any money back no matter what. There's no warranties, nothing. Mm-hmm. You're screwed.
So you can feel free to try to tinker because we encourage successful experiments, but we punish failed experiments.
Yep. With death.
With mostly with garnished wages.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And light death.
Yeah. You're likely to die as a Bureau of Shipping intern in the first place, right? So we don't
need to go out of our way for that.
Yeah, we don't make any special effort to keep you from dying in the case that you damage equipment.
Yeah. All right, next question comes from Beaky Bapa Boop, who says, Sam, do you ever run into spaghetti art in the same way that the other bros run into spaghetti code? Do you have any tips on keeping a piece of art clean, usable, and editable?
In Vector in particular?
This question is specifically about Vector, but in general.
Yeah, so definitely. There's a bunch of things on the Vector side to keep track of. So one is that Vector, unlike Raster, so Photoshop versus something like Inkscape, in the case of a vector program, you often don't need to bother too much with layer management. In fact, you can put everything just on – you just sort of work on a canvas and that's that. Because each of the things – each line that you draw, each shape that you put down is its own object that you can pick up and move around. So essentially, they all operate like they're on their own layers anyways in a traditional program. And so all that management of like moving stuff around, very easy. So the one thing that this sort of spaghetti art comes back to haunt you – is basically in two different ways. So one is if you don't track how it is you made something. So we just talked about this idea of R&D versus the grind. So if you don't track while you're in the R&D phase how it is that you got to whatever this end-looking thing is in a vector program in particular, because you cannot see the layers, right? You can't name individual pieces. You can't be like, yeah, I used this here. I tried this method here, which means that you will have to reverse engineer the process of any finished asset, unless one of the things I used to do is basically almost in phases. So I would, as I was building a particular thing, oftentimes for the first time, I would basically, once I completed the line work, then I would literally duplicate it swing a new, basically that new dupe out to the right, and then work on that to bring the next phase in. I'm like, here's the color work, here's whatever else. So that if I needed to come back to this project later, that I could actually see the individual phases of how I put this thing together. Now, when you're working in Photoshop or in any, like I work in Clip Studio Paint now, any layer-based thing, of course, it's all the information is actually preserved for you. Just you never flatten the image. So you end up just seeing each layer individually, which is super handy when you're coming back to. The one big thing I would say is that if you start using fancy brushes, any custom brushes whatsoever, on a particular layer. So say you're working on some rocks and you use some fancy brush you found on the internet that like has a cool rock texture. If you can't remember, if you have a bunch of brushes, a lot of people just end up with a shitload of brushes and you didn't name the damn layer about what that brush is. Cause I think the layers, it's a name, but like, who cares? You put whatever the fuck you want there. So put the brush name for your own sanity into that layer name. So that later when you come back, you can be like, okay, yeah, I'll just click that and get the thing.
Is it possible to like add notes or comments to layers?
No. Absolutely.
That's wild.
Yeah. That's wild. it sounds wild.
They've only been working on these products for what, 30 years? Like,
well, no, it sounds wild, but when you look at a lot of finished artworks that are like really high quality, a lot of illustration stuff, you're looking at literally hundreds of layers.
Which is more of a reason to have comments in them.
And yeah, tags.
But typically, I think the thing I've been finding most annoying is basically in jumping from vector to layer work is in once you start getting a project that has a lot of stuff going on, is in like you'll click on something, but you need to do something to the layer itself, which is in a slightly different submenu. And so you gotta get it to show up over there when there's the stack of 400 layers to dig through to find one thing. So some programs have hotkeys for doing that jumping. And then beyond that, it's basically like you will suffer the consequences of not cleaning up your sort of earlier passes on something later. You got to refactor a little bit. So before you hit into like the next phase, so say you just finished your line work or whatever else, clean up your nodes, like just remove some of the nodes, like just, you know, make stuff look good. If you're going to be animating the thing, know how you're going to be animating it ahead of time, because oftentimes in the case of literally any of these pieces, you'll actually want to bust those objects off onto their own kind of groups or own layers. So if I have an arm and I'm going to be like doing a bunch of shit with this arm, do not bake it into the whole image, because then you have to redraw the whole thing as opposed to just redrawing that arm later on, that sort of thing. So there's a lot of those horrifying process problems.
I think a lot of these lessons really they make sense when you just convey it. You're like, yeah, you know, like as you're developing the thing, take snapshots in vector and keep those for reference, clean things up afterwards. But what this truly means, I think, is really hard to understand until you've made a lot of mistakes and trapped yourself a bunch of times.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, it's mostly about every time something is hard for reasons that don't have to do with the thing itself, right? Every single time that happens, you must step back and ask, is there a thing I could do either now or moving forward to make this thing not hard? Like it's no matter what the discipline is, whether it's doing the art, no matter what kind of art, whether it's programming, whether it's anything, that is the way that this works, is that you fuck it up once. And you like the key is recognizing that something was hard. And when I say fuck it up, I don't mean you made a mistake. I mean something was hard, right? Or you made a mistake. Either way. So something is fucked and you ask, why? What could I do I've even been dealing with this. I've been trying to get back into Todoist to get my house chores dealt with, because my systems for managing my work just are not compatible with my systems for managing my normal life, you know? And what that's mostly meant is I've just fallen off of the horse over and over and over. Like I'm just a bleeding pulpy mess of horse damage from not being able to maintain my life outside of work.
Horse damage is super critical against Adam.
Yeah, exactly. So I got I've been trying to get back on Todoist, but part of it is actually discovering like what about using this, like what makes me not do this, right? And trying to recognize each time that happens. So it's even stuff like I've discovered that if you have a recurring item and it's got subtasks and you only do one of those tasks, and the next day now it says, oh, this is overdue, here's the rest of your tasks, right? So let's say that task was clean each of the three litter boxes in my house, right? Well, then now tomorrow it's just like, oh, you only need to clean these two. It's like, no, I still need to clean all fucking three of them every day. It's just that I like forgot or missed one or whatever the day before. And so it's like discovering that that means I need to break these things out into individual tasks and I can't have subtasks, right? And then things like when I was trying to just to do chores on Saturday and I was in the kitchen and I was like, okay, what can I do in here? And then I'm like looking through my list of to-do items. I'm like, which one of these can I do? It's like, oh, I need to actually organize, have a way to search these by room. I need a tag for the kitchen. You know, it's like, it's that kind of stuff. Every time a thing is just hard, just ask yourself, does it have to be?
What does it have to be? I had that with, so now that I've been actually posting on Instagram, it's annoying as hell doing that from, cause you can only post from a phone.
Yeah.
Do I do my fucking artwork on a phone? No, I don't. Which means that I would have to export things, find the files, put them in a Dropbox, upload them through my phone, type stuff on a phone. Can't copy and paste shit like without doing a bunch of difficult, you know, weird touch maneuvers on a phone. So there's a program called BlueStacks, which just runs, it's an Android emulator. So it's an Android OS that just runs on your fucking computer. So I do everything from my I post to Instagram from my computer, right? And it pulls up. It looks like
So you're running an emulated Android so that you can properly use Instagram from a computer?
Yeah, because that way that's I can go over. I have my hashtags or whatever those shits.
I was about to say.
Just copy paste those over.
I was about to say, why would they do that? But I know exactly why they would do that. Because when you're on your phone, you're not trying to produce or do anything useful. You're just trying to consume content, right? So like they want you to
pick your phone back up.
They want to get you into content like endless scrolling mode. It makes more money that way.
Yeah, my wife came up though and she saw me because I was getting my stuff ready and she's been on Instagram for a long time building all her stuff and she's like, what are you doing? And I was like, post on Instagram. She's like, you do it from your computer? And I was like, yeah, I mean, it's a pain in the ass. She was like, it is. I was like, yeah, join the party. Yeah,
it's the thing. It's the first step is just recognizing that a thing is a pain in the ass and then that it doesn't need to be ever. Cause there's always a fucking thing you can do. I think it'd be very cool actually once we get the art pipeline figured out. Cause Sam is still experimenting because we're using Clip Studio Paint and stuff like that. But there's already some really cool, clever stuff that we're doing that makes sense for, particularly for working with GameMaker, but presumably for games in general, for using like Sam's using animations as a way to have sprite sub images that aren't truly animations in a meaningful sense. And also organizing them in such a way that you can now have multiple of them in a single file, basically lined up as if they are sequences of animations happening,
I can hit play and I watch all 20 grass tiles stream by.
Yeah.
It's kind of nice.
And that's cool. But also what the end effect of that is that that allows an automated export, a batch export that puts things into a predictable organizational structure that we can then use to pull into the game. And so there's some cool stuff happening here that I think it'd be fun to put some videos together on, and then Sam talking about how you work, 'cause like you're watching Sam like organize the layers and trying to figure out how to manage the actual content of an art asset is really interesting, and it's something that I know Sam is like just actively rapidly experimenting with since it's all new, but it would be very cool at some point to sit down and put some videos together about how we do all of this stuff.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay, we got time for one more question, you guys. This is a big one, so are you ready? This comes from Fly Happy Axe Rampa, who says, you only covered no shaking hands while greeting someone. What about saying goodbye? Shaking hands is my number one go-to way to end a conversation. Now I'm stuck in conversations going, all right, well, okay, yeah.
You end it by being like, oh, and then like you put your hand out because it's somehow the physical signal is less uncomfortable than the
it is the definitely
body signal. Yeah, it's easier to use body language to convey I'm done now.
Okay, try the body language of cartoons where you just turn around and leave. If you watch, I noticed this in particular in Avatar: The Last Airbender. There was at some point, I don't know, like a season in, all of a sudden I noticed this, that when a character was done talking to another character, they would just turn around and leave.
Happens in drama too. So in any movie, you'll see people. Yeah, people walk. It's almost like people are coming in to give speeches and then they just leave. But that's how most of these relationships
work. That's also how they end phone calls. Someone would be like,
yeah, hey, they just hang up.
Can you pick up dinner? And the person's like, yeah, sure. And then they just hang up. Yeah. No human does this, but man, I mean, but think about this. Like, think about being on the receiving end of this. And if we all just accepted that this is not insulting. It just means the conversation's done now. And this is how you do it in like text messages or something, right? Like if somebody's texting you and you respond for a while, then at some point you just stop responding. You just like put the phone down or go do something else, and the conversation is pretty much done now, and that's it. So like, why is it that you can't just stop?
Yeah, I just love the idea of having a chat with someone and then just leaving. Because yeah. I think the thing is, while someone's pointing their body at you, it's like a tractor beam. You know, like you're not supposed to just turn around.
But it is interesting that we have this whole there's a gradual wind up and then a gradual wind down for as part of conversational niceties, right? And like, I wonder what it is that makes that a requirement. You know, like is that just a thing that's been established over time, and so that's what we do, or is there something about that that makes it just work better?
Mm-hmm. I don't know, but I mean, I think. Because I actually had this scenario where I was actually chatting with some of my neighbors yesterday. Oh, yeah. Where I was out walking the dog, bumped into some neighbors. So we, of course, nowadays you like chat from 20 feet away, which is even weirder. But
it's easier to turn around, to be honest, and just leave.
Yeah. But so we're chatting for a few minutes. And at a certain point, I was just like, all right, I'm going inside. See ya. Yep. And then I just went inside. And they're like, oh, yep, no problem. Have a good one, you know. And that was that. I think the problem is if you, because it's totally easy to do it tactfully by just saying, I'm gonna go do something else now. Yeah. If you're at a party and you're like, all right, I'm gonna go chat up some other folks. It was good talking to you. Like that's all you have to say. If you're gonna leave, you just be like, all right, I'm gonna leave now. It was great. It was great talking to you. Yeah, as long as you end it with a compliment or something, I feel like it's fine.
Oh yeah, definitely.
That's true. I think that part, like, it was nice chatting, right? Like, because that's the same thing as that handshake that you're going in for.
And also, you've already like you've put it in past tense now. You're like, well, it was great talking to you.
Yeah,
we're done. Yeah, we're done.
It's not going to be great anymore because it's over now. So I'm leaving.
It is the case though that it feels like there has to be a reason, right? Where you can't just say it was nice talking to you and then like leave. I mean, you can. Like, you definitely can do that, right? But you always feel like you have to then explain, like, here is the reason why I'm done talking to you. Yeah,
I
mean,
I know it feels like that, but I don't think it is. Because, like, honestly, if you were chatting with somebody and then you just say, all right, well, it was great talking to you.
Yeah. And honestly, that's a super good exit line. Yeah.
Because what you've done is you've framed the conversation in the past tense, which means you're announcing that it's over, but you're ending it with a nice compliment, being like, I had a great time.
Yeah, because you can't say we're done talking now and then have that be
you can't positive. Just suddenly go bye and then
yeah. I think that's a good method. Yeah.
I would love it. I would love it if we were all comfortable, because I mean, what is it? Is it an ego thing? Is it like it is kind of like, because you feel insulted. You know?
Well, yeah, it's not, but I think
if you're talking to somebody,
it's not an ego thing. You're just trying to read the room. You know, if someone's just like, "We're done talking now," and then leaves,
well, I think it's always
that can mean a lot.
You want people to like you, and you want them to not think that you don't like them, right?
Correct.
That's the thing we're trying to all manage. The reason that we have all these niceties is because we're all just paranoid constantly that people around us don't like us, right? Mm-hmm. That's why this all – so – because, yeah, it is the case if you just want to go talk to somebody, or even if you don't. Like, for me, like, I don't like being in social situations. And the bigger they get, the more I hate them, right? And so when I'm talking to somebody, like, I don't really want to – in that context, like, I don't really want to be there, period. So it's not even about that person at all, right? I just want to get out of there. It's like I just want to leave. And so the moment that I can, I want to be like, okay, I want to take off, right? But I don't want that person to think like, I don't want to talk to you. But
that's what I'm saying, though. It is about ego, because if you just say like, all right, bye, and then you leave, the person is thinking, what have I done? This is about me. Like, what have what does this person think about me?
Do they not like me? So much as it is just it's just social management.
Like, I'm not saying that the person has an inflated ego or anything like that. I'm just saying that it's hard not to think of it being about yourself. If you're talking to somebody if you're talking to somebody and they just suddenly go bye and then they walk off, then you're thinking, then now suddenly all you can think about is yourself and like how that person views you, what they think about you, what you said was wrong. And you don't think like maybe we just had a great conversation and that person just doesn't want to.
I think that's where the solution of just saying it was great talking to you. I'll see you later.
Right.
Yeah. So the weird part is when you do that and you're in a larger. So I think like every time I'm at GDC and we go to like those evening events or like when there are a lot of people around, I'm talking to one person and really I want to be not talking to anybody. Right. But
you just want to be standing in the side of the room.
I mean, ideally, I would be chilling, leaving or just like having a drink by myself, right? But like where I'm still stuck there, right? So now I've had a conversation with somebody, and I'm like, okay, so now like I want to end this conversation so I can just like not be doing this at all, right? But I don't get to leave the event yet because I still like really should be talking to some other people, right? Which means getting over that anxiety of like making that, you know, putting the hand out on the beginning of the conversation, right? And so now like you extricate yourself from one conversation and then you keep on seeing that person you were just talking to while you're not like talking to anybody else. Right. So like to me, that's where like from my own level of like social discomfort, like this is where it's at maximum is when I want to end one conversation in a room with lots of people and I don't want to start another one. Right. But probably should, but they haven't yet. So now it's like, I just said like, I don't want to talk to you or not. This, I didn't say that, but I was like, nice talking to you. The implication being, I'm going to go do something or talk to somebody else, right? And then I'm just standing there.
That's the hard part.
That feels like I have done something wrong, you know? Mm-hmm.
You've got two options. One is you immediately go just start chatting up another person, which as you noted is challenging. The other is you just go away for a while.
Yeah.
Go outside, go for a short walk.
I don't know if you guys feel this too, but every time I've talked to somebody, even at the beginning of a night, and then talked to a bunch of other people or whatever, and if every time I walk by them from that point forward, it's always like I don't know what to. I'm done with this, right? We've already talked. I'm finished with that part of the process.
Well, Adam, no. This is where the knowing glance comes in.
Yep.
You know, you're like,
give him a nod.
Give him a nod. I mean, that's like, what I do. We've shared a bond.
I mean, but every time I walk by and they don't re-engage, it feels like I'm making an active decision that implies something, right? Mm-hmm. Which is true, right? Because I'm not. The fact that I'm not re-engaging with that person is because I'm trying to re-engage with other people or no one or whatever, right? So like there's a truth there, but it's not a bad thing necessarily.
This reminds me when I was at DICE in February before the pandemic hit. It's basically the last conference you could go to. So it was at DICE and they had like an evening cocktail hour thing or whatever. And it's in this room and there's probably like 60 or 70 people in there. And the thing is I, for whatever reason, didn't know anyone. Despite all the time that we spent at these events on this first day who was there. And so that's brutal because you can't be in a conversation and then end up talking to two people. So the first one who you know and then the other people who you just don't know, which is like the easiest way to start getting like networked into a little group, a party. So I remember like – and every so often I have this – since I do most of the business networking stuff for us, every so often it does hit me really fucking hard where I'm like, I wish someone – was just talk to me instead of me having. Because I did laps around this like little art exhibit thing. Did like probably four laps or so before I finally like got into a conversation with someone. And the whole time, Adam, like you said, I'm just moseying around. There's not even anything to do. I'm just fucking walking in circles.
Yeah,
and I'm
I like, feel so fucking.
Ooh, the thing is, everyone is so self conscious that I was like, no one.
I know everyone's also doing, but it is true though. Like I very rarely am approached by somebody else to chat in those contexts. It's always like I have to do it if it's going to happen.
Correct.
And which is then part of also that anxiety on your own side. You're like, does nobody want to talk to me? Right. Which, of course, the answer is like they don't know who the fuck you are. And if they do, the likelihood there are far fewer people who are like extroverts who want to just go grab your hand and start talking, right? Than there are people who are a little uncomfortable in that situation, at least a bit, right?
So I think there's a solution to this, which covers all bases. Okay. You go into a social situation, you're thinking about yourself. You're thinking like, how do I get people to talk to me? How do I engage with people? How can I get into this group so that they'll commute, like, so I can meet people? What if you come into it with a different mission, which is like, how do I get as many people to talk to each other as possible?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then now it's no longer about you. Now you've suddenly reframed the problem. Big brain quarter. Okay. You've reframed the problem and you're thinking now like, I'm going to go just start chatting with people, not because I care what they think about me or any of that stuff. I just want to get to know some stuff about them and then quickly go and like chat with some other folks and see if I can like bring people together.
Oh yeah. No, this is actually how
rope people in.
Yeah. This is basically how I get through those things. Cause it's, you have to reorient and then be the person who's like, I'm going to go make people comfortable. That's like, that's my job here.
That's my goal. Yeah.
I can tell everybody who's just standing there holding a drink, looking like a weirdo. Cause like, I don't want to talk to you yet. Like,
just go talk to them.
They're not comfortable right now. And like, if I go say, hey, tell me what you do, then they'll light up and then be able to talk about stuff. So yeah, you're absolutely right.
Or they'll be a weirdo and you got to extricate yourself from that situation.
You know? And you're just like, hey, it's good talking to you.
You know? It was weird talking to you. But we did it. You know, we're here now. We did
it. Let's not do it again.
We got through it. all right. Well, I think that covers it. So I hope that was, medium helpful.
Also, anybody listening, if you've been curious what the weird percussive noises are, we've got roofers on our roof doing something.
I actually haven't heard anything.
Have you not heard anything? Because I can see it on my little, little squiggly bumps. You know, the squiggly bumps from your audio recording?
Yep.
I can see it in there, but it is quieter than my voice. So hopefully.
I think it's fine.
Yeah, you're good.
It's not
you're
too annoying.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jed Costa, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, go to podcast.bscotch.net. We have links to everything you could ever want out of life, so just go there, click every link. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.